the digital disruption that we talked about in the technology fallacy is what we're calling chronic disruption. So it happens over a slow period of time. You have little more time to respond to it. You can live with it for a while without making action. In contrast, an acute disruption, you know, hits hard and you're forced to deal with it. But many of the transformative things that companies are doing are the same in both settings. And in fact, it's accelerated the plans that companies have had in place for digital transformation.
The Digital to Learn podcast is dedicated to exploring both what's new and what's good in the use of technology in teaching and learning.
Our mission is to have the best minds sitting in front of our microphones sharing evidence-based strategies for digital teaching and learning.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
Thank you for joining us. And now, the Digital to Learn podcast.
Hi, this is Tiffany Snyder on the Digital to Learn podcast, and I'm here with my co-host, Brad Garner. Hey, Brad.
Hello. Welcome.
Thanks. Brad recently purchased and read a book that inspired him to reach out to two excellent guests, which we have with us today. We have Jerry Kane and Ann Phillips.
Jerry Kane is a professor of information systems and faculty director of the Edmund H. Shea Jr. Center for Entrepreneurship at Boston College's Carroll School of Management. He is also the guest editor for Digital Leadership at MIT Sloan Management Review and a senior editor at MIS Quarterly. He teaches about how companies respond to digital disruption to undergraduate, graduate, and executive education students worldwide. Jerry's research interests involve how organizations develop strategy, culture, and talent in response to changes in the competitive landscape wrought by digital technology, such as social media, mobile devices, the Internet of Things, analytics, and emerging technologies. His published research has appeared in the MIS Quarterly, Information Systems Research, Organization Science, Management Science, Marketing Science, the Harvard Business Review, and the MIT Sloan Management Review. Jerry received his PhD from Emory University and his MBA in Computer Information Systems from Georgia State University. Also joining us is Ann Phillips, a co-author of the book Technology Fallacy. Ann currently works as senior manager for Deloitte's CIO program, leading strategic research and thought leadership initiatives in the U.S. Prior to her current role, she spent 12 years in Deloitte Consulting LLP, leading business and technology teams in implementing computer relationship management and order management solutions for large telecommunications and retail clients. Ann is vitally interested in the impact of emerging digital technology on an organization's leadership, talent, and culture. Her work has been cited in leading publications such as the Wall Street Journal, the MIT Sloan Management Review, Forbes, and Fortune.
Welcome to both of you.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Hi, it's good to be here.
We'd like to begin with some ridiculous questions, then we get really serious. So we're going to ask you to make some choices. Would you rather? And the first one is, would you rather live your entire life in virtual reality where all your wishes are granted, or just the normal real world?
I can't believe you're asking me this question in July of 2020. I would go anything to be in a virtual world right now and escape all this stuff that we're dealing with.
That does make a difference, doesn't it? How about you, Ann?
Absolutely.
Actually, I was going to say the opposite. I feel like I live in a virtual world all day being on Zoom. So, real world, please. Just wish it would change a little bit.
Absolutely. Absolutely right.
Yeah. All right. Would you rather find $5 on the ground or find all of your missing socks?
Ann, you want to go first on this one?
Yeah, I would say if I had missing socks, I would say all of my missing socks.
Are you that organized?
I can't think of any socks I'm missing.
She is.
Oh, wow. We're going to have you back just to talk about that. That topic.
For me, if you throw in finding all of my son's missing socks as well, or even not even mine, just his would be a godsend.
That is the problem.
Very good. Okay, would you rather meet your favorite fictional character or your favorite musician?
I'll go with fictional character. you know, who wouldn't want to meet Harry Potter? And then he can you know, cast spells for you, and all that sort of stuff.
So Harry Potter would be your choice too for fictional characters?
Certainly on the list. I mean,
okay,
talking about Star Wars universe and all of that sort of stuff too. I mean, it's just, there's lots of choices.
Would that be your virtual reality world, to go back to question one too?
That's a good question. I am, if you've ever read the book Ready Player One, that's sort of my, the oasis there is my idea of the virtual world I'd like to inhabit.
So, Juan, what would your choice be?
So you'll probably see a pattern here between me and Jerry. So I would vote for the real life musician.
And who might that be?
Oh gosh, see, this is tough. But you know, maybe some of the legends like Paul McCartney.
Excellent choice. Excellent choice. I think we're siding with Ann here early on, Jerry, just so you know.
That's fine. I'm used to that. Everybody likes her better than me anyway.
Yeah. Okay, this next question definitely comes from Brad, but I'm going to be asking it, so I feel like I need to preface it that way. Would you rather always stink and not know it, or always smell something that stinks that nobody else smells?
Hmm. All right.
It's very provocative, isn't it?
Yes.
Extremely. So this is a little bit of a tough one. First of all, I would have to go with always smelling something that no one else smells, because I'm of the belief that no one else should have to suffer. But, you know, if I can suffer and nobody else suffers, that's better. But I'm a little torn because I love food, and I'm assuming that that would affect my taste.
Excellent analysis.
So I will actually side with Ann on this one, but for a different reason. I'm going to geek out on you here and say that the human brain is a remarkably plastic organ, and it would learn to not smell that stinky thing over time. It would learn to sort of filter that out. And so I would get over it.
That's good.
And you're correct. That is a very geeky answer.
My family is used to it by now.
we'll be used to it by the time this podcast is over, I promise.
Perhaps. Yeah.
Okay, last question, and then we'll get serious. Would you rather travel in time and meet your great-great-great-grandparents or meet your great-great-grandchildren?
I'm a future-looking girl.
Okay.
So I would say the great-great. How many greats was that?
Three greats. Great, great, great.
Great, great, great grandchildren.
Yeah. You know, and honestly, I would say Ann's answer. But just to be provocative and different, I would say there's a family story that says somewhere along the line in my family history, I don't remember where it came from, but one of my great-great-grandmothers had a fortune and was swindled it out of it by a gigolo type character. And so I would, if that is true, I would go back and offer her words of caution to try and preserve that fortune for
my
later generations.
Oh, that's great. Wow. Okay, let's get serious. Let's talk about this book you wrote. The book is Technology Fallacy, for those who are listening. And I know there are many millions doing that right now. But it's the result of an extensive research project, which makes it, I think, even more valuable. So how did that all get started? How did the two of you engage with this idea?
Jerry, do you want me to take this one?
Absolutely. You were there first.
Okay, well, this all started a number of years ago when Deloitte started a collaborative research project with MIT Sloan Management Review on the topic of digital transformation. Actually, it started with social business, and we met Jerry as a professor that we interviewed through that research project, and we got him onto the team. He joined the party, and then we eventually transitioned our research over to study digital transformation more specifically. So we did that for 5 years between Deloitte and MIT Sloan Management Review, with Jerry serving as the guest editor. And, you know, it grew into something that was much bigger than what we saw in our annual reports every year. So we felt that this was a story that had to get out, and that was what compelled us to write this book. And actually, Jerry with Itching the Right One.
Yes.
So from the time you decided to write the book, or Jerry proposed that idea, how long did it take to get it finished?
That's a good question. Well,
that's pretty, depends on when you count the beginning.
You know, we'd been working on the research project for probably 3 years before we even started talking about the book. Hmm. And then it was probably a year to 18 months but from the time we started talking about the book to the when we actually started working on the book. And then once we had a contract, it all came to pass in about a year.
Okay. Wow. And so glad you made that decision, because it is just a remarkable piece of work and such a relevant message for today.
Well, I enjoyed working on the project much more than I ever thought I would. Actually, also proved to be much more challenging than I ever thought it would. You know, I write for a living, but writing a book versus an academic paper is an entirely different exercise. But we had a really great author team that worked well together. There were four of us, and we just, everybody added something different to the manuscript. So the whole is a lot better than the sum of its parts. And we enjoyed the process so much, we're actually in process on book number two.
I knew it. That was my next question.
Great. How soon might we see that book? How soon might we have you back on the podcast?
You can have us back whenever. I mean, we're doing the research now and learning a ton of interesting stuff. It's due out next year. The deadline is actually mid-October, so we're a little bit frantic and panicking about it all. But what we're doing, what we learned is, as we have been presenting the results of the technology fallacy over the past year or so, we were presenting as the COVID-19 stuff really started to hit. And we realized that many of the lessons of the technology fallacy actually apply remarkably well to what companies are dealing with. And we're curious why. And so we actually have our first article coming out from the book, because we distinguish between chronic and acute disruption. And we really think that the digital disruption that we talked about in the technology fallacy is what we're calling chronic disruption. So it happens over a slow period of time. You have a little more time to respond to it. You can live with it for a while without making action. In contrast, an acute disruption, you know, hits hard, and you're forced to deal with it. But many of the transformative things that companies are doing are the same in both settings. And in fact, it's accelerated the plans that companies have had in place for digital transformation. And we've just had some fascinating interviews.
Now, for those that don't know anything about the research behind the book, can you talk a little bit more about who you studied and what you studied and just more about the research?
Yeah, so over 5 years, what we did was we took a look at, we really wanted to understand what companies were doing with this idea of digital transformation, right? You hear the phrase being thrown out there, and we wanted to know what was going on. And what we found pretty early on was that a lot of organizations were struggling, not with technology, but they were struggling with their organization overall. Mm-hmm. And how to get it to be a little bit more transformational, how to get it to be faster, more nimble, more collaborative. And I think that's something that a lot of people don't think about, because if you just think about the phrase digital transformation, there's a word digital in it. And people assume that just because it has digital in it, it means that, well, in order for me to be digitally transformed, I need to implement a lot of technologies. And that's absolutely part of the solution, but it's actually not necessarily the hardest part of the solution. The part that's probably the more obvious, right? And it's critically important, but it tends to not be what people get tripped up on. Mm-hmm. And when you ask about the people that we studied, we, over 5 years, interviewed a number of folks, executives, key leaders, but then we also did a series of surveys that examined people's perspectives across the organization, right? So from top to bottom of the organization, as well as across industries and across geographies. So it really is a global study with anywhere between 4,000 and 5,000 survey responses every year.
Wow.
With people across the organization and their perspectives on what their company is doing to sort of tackle this concept of digital transformation.
And just as a funny story to piggyback on that, because I don't think Alan specifically said it. So the last thing we came up with when we were writing the book was the title. And we never actually explain what the technology fallacy is in the book. And I've since discussed it is just in the way that Alan was framing it. The technology fallacy is this mistaken assumption that just because a company's challenges are caused by digital technologies, that the solutions also necessarily involve digital technologies as well, because many times the solutions are organizational, managerial, talent-based, et cetera, et cetera. So the problems are digital, but the solutions don't necessarily need to be. And that's a mistake that many organizations make, jumping to digital because they think that needs to be in the response.
When looking at your results, what were some of the things that were consistent with what you expected? And then was there anything surprising that jumped out at you?
Oh, my favorite stuff is the stuff that was surprising. And there are some ones that I went in either thinking it was going to be exactly opposite or just came from out of the blue. One is I had this working hypothesis that, you know, something basic, that digitally maturing companies, the more advanced ones, would have better digital leaders. And they did, but even 50% of respondents from digitally maturing companies said we need newer, better leaders to compete in a digital world. The biggest difference was not whether they had the digital leaders, but was whether they were doing something to develop those leaders. So therein lies the difference. I had this hypothesis that digitally maturing companies were going to be more experimental. And it turns out everybody experiments. What sets the digitally maturing companies apart is they do something with the experiments once they're successful. They then use it to drive change across the organization. And there are two or three of those that is just like, huh, I thought it was good. Last one, just because I'm on a roll, I was really interested in looking at the cultural characteristics. And I had this image that we'd have different types of digitally maturing companies with different approaches to it. And in fact, when we crunched the data, it came back almost exactly correlated with our early developing and maturing framework, suggesting that these types of companies have very different cultures than one another, and that the culture is a great place to start when you're trying to transform digitally.
I knew you were going to bring up that culture one. And the funny thing is, I know that you're surprised by it, but I was actually hoping there would be some common traits. I think what's really interesting is that, you know, the biggest thing, right? We didn't expect this to be about people. And it really boiled down to that. So when Jerry talked about the fact that everyone is looking for new leaders, and what sets apart digitally maturing organizations is that they develop their leaders, well, we actually see an almost identical graph when it comes to talent. So everyone's saying, oh, we need talent. We need new skill sets in our organization. But again, what sets apart the digitally maturing organizations is the fact that they actually develop their talent. So they're focused on their people, they're focused on their talent, they're focused on their leadership, and developing that within is actually what really sets them apart. And it boils down to learning and mindset.
Interesting.
The majority of our listeners are university faculty, so kind of taking this idea into that realm. You share in the introduction a quote, and it says, it's about how to manage disruption, adapt to disruption, and thrive in a world and a time marked by disruption. How would you relate this goal to the manner in which higher education is handling the COVID-19 pandemic?
Alan, I assume you want me to deal with this one since I'm the faculty representative here. You know, it's been really interesting, and I don't think we yet know how universities are responding to the COVID-19 pandemic, because I think we'll know more in a month. Step one, I'm a guy who studied digital collaboration for, you know, 15 to 20 years, and I was shocked at how well everybody pivoted to Zoom on March 13th when everything shut down. You know, colleagues who are technophobic, who I have been sort of beating the drum about what's possible in the classroom with technology, really stepped up, at least in my university, and did an admirable job on, you know, under intense pressure. I was very impressed with the degree to which my colleagues stepped forward and did it. How we're now dealing with the next generation, I think that's going to be a real question about how do we come back on campus. I think it's going to vary by whether people are going purely online versus hybrid versus purely face-to-face, and which decision was the right decision for each university. Yeah. And that's not going to be the same. I know for us, we are planning to meet in person to a hybrid, you know, a de-densified, socially distant version. You know, my question is whether the socially distant in-person classroom is going to be superior to the virtual learning. And that, I think, is an open question. And if anything, I hope it makes us think about what options are available out there. Because, you know, I've been beating the drum on this for 10 years, that I really think higher ed needs to move away from, I would argue we're in the golden age of education right now. There's so, my son in the lockdown, you know, school was a challenge. He's been using Udemy to learn Python for the past 2 months and just something he couldn't get in school. And he's figuring out ways to do it on his own. And I think universities, we fundamentally, this whole idea of that, you know, educating 18 to 22 year olds as your primary thing, when we show in the book that ongoing learning is really the key to keeping yourself fresh in a digital world, how can we rethink institutions of higher ed as a platform, like a Facebook, like a Google, and how we bring together different components to teach one another? So the class I teach is called Tech Trek. I teach students for a half semester, and then we take them to either San Francisco or Silicon Valley to meet with tech executives, most of whom are alumni. Obviously, that's disrupted. You know, we're not taking anybody to San Francisco or to New York in the next year. So how do we rethink this? Well, what we're doing is all the folks that we would have been meeting with out at these places, we're bringing in via Zoom. And that opens up opportunities for us, because previously we were limited to executives in the location. Now we can go global with the people we bring in. Why are we not doing more of this type of thing? But it's fundamentally rethinking what higher ed is, how it is delivered. But I think there are so many opportunities out there. And then, you know, it becomes a revenue issue. But if you're connecting with these executives later in life and providing them value, there's a way to monetize that as well. And so if anything, you know, I think my hope is what we're recommending in book number two is the companies that are going to be successful are those that are going to innovate through this crisis. I think the same thing applies to higher ed. Those that are going to really emerge stronger are going to be ones that figure out how to use this opportunity to deliver new educational approaches, to deliver new models that are going to carry them into the next 20 or 30 years. Because I would argue higher ed is ripe for disruption. And relying exclusively on the face-to-face campus, I'm not saying we do get rid of the face-to-face campus, but why is it only that? Or why is it even primarily that? How can we rethink education that's, you know, for a digitally disrupted world as well as a COVID disrupted world? So I will end there.
There was too much content to cover in one episode. We're bringing our guests back next week for part two of the conversation. Please join us.
Thank you for joining us on Digital to Learn.
If you enjoyed this podcast, there are three things we ask you to do. One, come back and join us again. Two, tell your friends about us. And three, give us a positive ranking on your favorite podcast platform.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
It's a digital world.
Always keep learning.